So welcome everyone and good evening. I'm Joe Galuski, for those of you who I don't know yet. And welcome. I'm very happy to be able to introduce tonight's speaker. Catherine Thanis is the abbot of Santa Cruz Zen Center in California. And she also was my first Zen teacher beginning about 18 years ago. So it's a real treat to have her here. She began practicing in 1967 at San Francisco Zen Center with Suzuki Roshi, and was ordained in 1975, I believe, and received Dharma transmission in 1988, and has been teaching in Santa Cruz and Monterey, California since around 1990. It's just been a real pleasure to spend the last several days with her here, so I hope you'll enjoy the talk tonight. So join me in welcoming Catherine.
Thank you. Can you all? There's somebody hidden back there.
Two of us. There are going to be a couple of us hidden, I think.
I can see you.
Can you see each other? Thank you, Joe. Dr. Galuski. Reverend Galuski. And where's the other Reverend Galuski?
She may join us if she can. I think that's the plan.
It's really wonderful to be here with all of you. My friend Basia and I have been enjoying so much being in New Mexico, enjoying Albuquerque, and I got up to Santa Fe for a couple of days. We love the sky, marvelous sky, and the landscape here. The landscape has a lot of breath in it. It's not quite as busy here as we're used to being in San Francisco for her and Santa Cruz for myself. Very busy in California. So I want to talk about what I've been thinking about the last few months. And I also want to talk about it in with the language of Dogen Zenji. Does anybody here know who Dogen Zenji is? Oh, good. So those of you who raised your hands are already, you've been practicing for a while and studying. You too?
No. I couldn't hear you. I thought you were asking whether everyone could hear you.
Can everyone hear me? Mm-hmm. Please raise your hand if you can't. Do you want to sit closer?
Thank you.
Sure. Are you related to Inga, by any chance?
I'm sorry?
You're related to Inga, by any chance?
I'm her aunt. Yes. We met once before.
How nice of you to come. Thank you.
She said you were coming to Albuquerque. Seemed like the least I could do.
So I better speak up.
Yes, I have to report back to her.
So can I have some idea of how long you've been practicing, those of you who have been practicing? I don't know who you are, basically.
I think the group ranges from a year and a half of practice up to maybe 30 or plus years of practice.
Who's the 30 plus?
Well, I've been practicing since 1984. But I'm not good. 1994? 84. Mm-hmm.
Here in New Mexico?
No, I started in Seattle. Seattle Zen Center.
Is that with a Rinzai teacher? Is that Hirata Roshi?
No, Genki Roshi at first.
Genko?
Genki Roshi. And then Glenn. I'm not remembering his last name. I'm sorry, he took over.
Oh. Welcome. You should probably be sitting here giving a talk. how about others?
Four on and off, but
4 years?
But more consistently 6 months.
For the last 6 months?
Yeah.
Good. How about you?
I'm right there with her. My answer. About 5 years on and off, but consistently only, well, the latest consistent round has only been a few months.
Okay. How about you?
I am a beginner. I used to meditate years ago, and then I kind of found my way back. I took a retreat at Upaya recently and just found that calling again. So here I am.
Yeah. It draws you back, doesn't
it?
It
does. It does.
Yeah. And okay. Got you. 30 years, huh?
41.
40.
41.
I guess the reason I'm asking about your practice is because I want to find out what expectations people have of practice. Anybody have any? So you're a beginner. Do you have any expectations?
Not really. No, I have really gone into it just being as open. And I think it's helped actually a lot. I think when I was doing meditation back in my college years, it was forced. I took a class and... I wasn't forced to take the class, but it just, I felt like I had to. But now I'm at a different place in my life. So it's more of a wanting.
And you don't have any expectations?
Not at the moment, no.
Stick around.
Yeah, exactly. I know. I will. But
they will show up. Anybody else have expectations they're willing to confess to? There's a hand. Yours.
I've been practicing for 2.5 years. It's about 2.5 years.
Uh-huh.
And I notice my expectations most when I don't have any sort of formulated expectations, but I expect, I certainly must expect something, because when I find myself getting upset, I think, oh, I shouldn't be that way. I should be more calm and something like that. So that my expectations kind of show up when something happens, or I'm in some sort of state of mind that for some reason I think I should not be in.
So you have some idea.
Yeah, definitely.
Of how you should be.
Yes.
Now that you're meditating. But before?
Well, I still would have liked to have been that way, but now, since I'm doing this, I want to be that way even more, or expect to be that way more of the time, I guess.
Thank you. I'm just wondering, that tends to be what happens. We're meditating, so how come we're not better? Anybody else?
I guess I don't really meditate that often, but when I do it, it's because I'm trying to ease some anxiety and just stay, you know, simple and stay in the moment.
Does it help?
I usually do a lot of just everyday sort of awareness of my body and awareness. I don't meditate a whole lot, but I do use, or a sort of a simplified form of it. I use a simplified form of it just in my everyday life, I think. just to ease anxiety.
One of the things I've discovered, is that when the mind gets busy and gets obsessive, it's really hard to stop it. It kind of feeds on
mm-hmm.
its obsessiveness. If you can change the subject and come to your body, it has to be something that's interesting enough for the mind to stay with it. It will really calm the mind. With the mind, you can turn the channel. You know, instead of being irritated with somebody, you can turn the channel to another mode of thinking, another flavor of the mind. Many of us have trouble sleeping, and including myself at times, and I've noticed that my mind gets very busy when I go to bed. But if I go to my breathing and stay with the breath, it really, and can stay with the breath because the breath is deep enough and quiet enough, I'm not so agitated and I can sleep. It's like the body can calm down. So thinking takes us out of the body. And Zazen is a body practice. It's really a body practice. And it's very helpful to be able to find a posture that's upright. And you do give a lot of Zazen posture instruction.
Some.
It's so important how, the lower body comes in. And it's kind of like when you're standing, it's the same alignment of the body, the pelvis, the upper body, the heart, the neck, the head coming in of the chin. And this alignment makes a big difference. And I couldn't do this for a long time. If you can't do this, it doesn't mean you can't practice, you can't do Zazen. But I'd like to encourage you to pay attention to the body and to do, if you can, either yoga or some body work that will help ease the tensions in the body. Most of us are carrying a lot of tensions in our body, including myself. I think just being alive in our society, we carry tension. We have expectations of ourselves. We continuously disappoint ourselves, it seems like. So as long as we are carrying, hopes, expectations, ideas about how we should be, and then finding that that isn't really how we should show up, there's going to be some tension. So that the first thing I wanted to say about Zazen and your practice is something about paying attention to the body and reading about it, although getting Joe or Russ to do some practice, alignment practice, opening the heart. I mean, we can say these things, and it's really hard to do when your shoulders are up like this. Mine spend a lot of time up like this, so it's really an effort. You can't just by will change your body. But if you can, find some practice to do. I'd like to encourage you, because this capacity for going to the breath and coming out of the mind is aided by the posture, your alignment. There is a student in Santa Cruz who complained that she's been practicing for 20 years and she's not realizing her expectation of how what kind of change she imagined or hoped for. She hasn't changed. She's still the same person. That's why I asked about expectations. Because we have the idea when we come to practice that's a kind of therapy, and if we sit long enough, we'll become our idealized image of ourselves. I started sitting with Suzuki Roshi in 67, got a Gary Roshi, and we were pretty naive in those days, and I thought, gee, if I sit long enough, I'll become Suzuki Roshi. You know, I'll have the presence and the kindness and compassion that we felt with him. And somewhere around 30 years later, a little realization arises that I'm probably not going to become Suzuki Roshi. In fact, the teaching is, when you become you, Zen becomes Zen. And our actual practice, and I can't say this strongly enough, is to be as authentically yourself as you can. Hear me?
More or less.
Come closer. Because as I noticed when people begin to practice, they want so much to become bodhisattvas, enlightenment workers, that they have a hard time acknowledging that they are not generous, not patient, aren't following the precepts, can't follow the precepts. Don't get to meditation every day. It's very hard to know who the person is because they're often trying to present themselves as they think they should be to themselves as well as to their teacher. And I did the same thing, so I understand this. And I was watching my thoughts. My assignment when I started, Suzuki Roshi asked us to count our thoughts. count our breaths, excuse me.
My goodness.
Counting our thoughts would be interesting, wouldn't it? Counting our breath. And I did that for 13 years. And the teacher that I was working with at that point said I could stop. You know, we're very good at counting our breaths and also having the mind running on. You can become very good at that. If your mental functioning is highly developed, as most of us are in this culture, we're a pretty mental culture, so all of us feel comfortable in the mental realm, and we don't feel so comfortable in the body realm. So in a way, practice is to help us drop down from the thoughts and ideas and feelings to the sensations in the body, to the body. Coming down to the body is coming to your coming to your original undivided self. With the mind, we develop a divided sense of ourself. Many judgments, many feelings, many complaints, many irritations, many doubts, many hesitations. But coming to the body, if when we can, go back and forth when we can, we don't have judgments, because we have too many judgments about our bodies. But it's a way of experiencing the truth of your experience, your mind-body, without judgment. It's really, I just want to encourage you to come out of your idealized, you know, it's funny, I used to think when I was counting my breaths and watching a lot of thoughts going back and forth, I used to think, gee, these are little thoughts, they're irrelevant, they don't count. I don't have to pay attention to them. So for many years, I did not pay attention to the kind of thoughts that were arising in my mind. And I did not notice the kinds of thoughts that I had, my negative thoughts, my doubtful thoughts, the range of impatient thoughts, insecure thoughts, ungenerous thoughts, competition thoughts, jealousy, all that stuff. I thought they were fleeting, and I didn't have to account for them. That certainly wasn't what my teacher was interested in, you know. I was trying to, I don't know what I was trying to do, but I wasn't noticing that part of myself, my small mind. So it's possible to do meditation for a long time and not really get to know what your mind is doing, the kinds of thoughts and feelings, concepts that are being generated in your mind and that drive you, that direct you. The mind has many possibilities. There's angry mind, there's impatient mind, there's irritable mind, there's generous mind, there's loving mind, there's calm mind. The mind can go through many phases. And I've been noticing that the object of my irritation is not what I think, the story I tell, but that my mind is irritated at that point for whatever reason. And when the mind is irritated, it lands on an object. Whatever object is around, you will become irritated by it. It's not, the problem isn't the object, the problem is in the mind. So if we don't take I notice this because when I have body work, probably some of you are blessed and can have body work. When I come out of body work, I'm so relaxed. Nothing bothers me. And I notice that all the kinds of irritations, if I go shopping at the grocery store or someplace, you know, people don't seem to get in my way at that time. My heart is open and my body is relaxed, and therefore my mind is relaxed. If your body's relaxed, your mind is comfortable, your mind is relaxed. And it's such a wonderful feeling. And when I'm driving, I'm a more generous driver. So I got to realize that the mind, the condition of the mind is what determines what the problem is, not the object. This is really important to notice. So it's important to become acquainted with the condition of the mind. Notice when you're irritated. Notice when you don't like what you're eating or how it's cooked. Or any of that kind of thing. What's going on? And you can watch TV and you're going to get very worked up. what I've been thinking about is the two main streams of consciousness that we're working with in our practice, in our lives. One is our karmic mind, our habit mind, our familiar mind. Everybody know what I mean by that? The karmic mind is the mind that you grew up with in this culture. Your parents, your habits, your siblings, yeah, the media, the culture, your teachers, the thoughts, the values that you have cultivated, developed from growing up in this culture. What's good, what's bad, what goals you should have for yourself, what your ambitions are, what your fears are. Fear of failure, right? Fear of failure. As compared, the bodhisattva stream, the big mind stream, I think of as coming out of the precepts. You know, we love to have certain ceremonies. Some of you have been to ceremonies or have taken a lay initiation or priest initiation. And we have, we take precepts like a disciple of Buddha does not take life. A disciple of Buddha does not take what is not given. A disciple of Buddha does not misuse sexuality, does not lie, does not intoxicate mind or body of self or other, does not slander, does not praise self, does not harbor ill will, is not possessive of anything. What's the last one? Does not abuse the three treasures, Buddha, Dharma, Sangha. When we hear those precepts and when we take those precepts, we are inspired. We come to practice with the hope of becoming a person who does not take life, does not take what is not given, who really lives that kind of life. At the same time, if you try, does not judge, does not did not slander, does not intoxicate, doesn't take use drugs. Someone who has is living kind of free of the judgments, the fears, the irritations of normal life, everyday life, habit life. And yet, when we try to practice, you can take on, say, if you've been practicing for a while, you can take on one of these practices, not to slander, not to praise self, not to judge. And if you try to do it, you might find that it's hard to do. You might find there's a little competition with some other voice in you, some other, I think of it as moral imperative. My habit mind, very strong. We have a moral imperative from our culture to stand up for ourselves, to succeed, to not let anyone get ahead of us, kind of, or take advantage of us. The first one is the first mind, the bodhisattva mind, is not being so self-centered. It's being more generous. It's seeing ourselves as part of a larger community of humanity. We're not separate from anyone. We are not separate. Whatever we are going through, whatever our lives are about, not so different from other people's lives. That's the thought that inspires us. But that thought competes with the imperative from our culture, our habit mind, to do something else, to take care of this one, take care of number one, not to let anybody get a, you know, take advantage of you. It's really tricky to watch yourself trying to be patient and generous and giving and unselfish, and at the same time find this other voice coming from some deep place inside, because it's the voice we grew up with, that's pushing at us, resisting that generosity. So I think we have to, I'm bringing this up because I think these two voices are competing with us, with each other in practice. And until we get very familiar with the habit voice, we're not really working directly as we should be in practice. Because we have to know how impatient we are. We have to know how ungenerous we are. We have to know how undisciplined we are. To really have compassion for ourselves. And to really learn to be affectionate and trusting of this one. We're always kind of making excuses for ourselves when we eat more than we should eat, or when we take more than our share. We don't do really what we feel like we should do. But to really feel like it's okay, that you have some soft, loving, generous feeling about yourself. Unless you take care of yourself in that way, it's almost impossible, I think, to have generous, soft, loving feelings for others, because you will be constantly judging their failures, their inadequacies. You accept your own, sort of, but at some level you don't. You're disappointed with yourself. Some years ago, I worked on a fascicle of Dogen's Zenji, which I want to recommend to you. I don't know how many of you have read, looked at his fascicles in the book Beyond Thinking. Does anybody know who Dogen's Zenji is? Yeah, you do. He's the founder of the Soto School in Japan. And he's put down many of the teachings that we have been studying to understand this practice more deeply. The one that I had the opportunity to work with Kaz Tanahashi in the translation of a few of these. And this is the third volume of his writings that Kaz Tanahashi, who's a poet and a social activist and a father, has assembled. And many of us at San Francisco Zen Center worked with him to work on the language and the comprehension of his fascicles. This particular one, when I started looking at it again a few days ago, I realized that it's exactly in Dogen's language what I'm talking about. The habit stream and the Bodhisattva consciousness. These are two different consciousnesses. Okay, everybody kind of with me?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, okay. So, this is called Ocean Mudra Samadhi. A mudra, we call this the mudra of the hands in Zazen. So mudra is posture, and this is also the mudra of Zazen, the whole body. So that's what two meanings of mudra. So Ocean Mudra Samadhi. So samadhi is like concentration, deep settled concentration. This is he's talking about the concentration or the stability of mind in the mode of the ocean. I'll just read a little bit. Buddhas and ancestors continuously maintain Ocean Mudra Samadhi. When I was working with him on this, I didn't understand it. It's really interesting, but when I looked at it the other day, it was, oh, that's what he's talking about, bodhisattva mind and habit mind. While swimming in this samadhi, they expound, they realize, and practice. So when we're in concentration, settled concentration, they talk, they have experiences, they realize, and they practice. Traveling through water includes journeying along the ocean bottom. This is called coursing along the bottom of the deepest ocean. This ocean, the deepest ocean, bottom of the ocean, differs from the sea of birth and death, where Buddhas guide drifting beings to the shore of liberation. That's karmic mind. So journeying on the bottom of the ocean, deep, settled consciousness, breathing, body, that's different from the sea of birth and death. That's so interesting. In a way, when you begin to think of it in these terms, it just becomes kind of transparent. This ocean differs from the sea of birth and death, where Buddhas guide living beings to the shore of liberation. Each Buddha ancestor breaks through the bamboo node. That's a translation of that is intellectual thinking. Breaks through thinking mind and passes the barrier individually. This is done only through the power of the Ocean Mudra Samadhi. So each of us has to break through our ideas, our concepts, our thoughts. This is really tricky because if you have an idea and you feel really strongly about it, it's very hard to drop it and to allow some other experience or thought or feeling or realization or understanding. You know, what if you think you have a cold or some issue with your body? If you make up your mind that whatever experience you're having with your body represents whatever, it's very hard just to see the sensation in your body independent of that idea. You're going to treat it. You know, you're going to get worried. You're going to call your friends. You're going to call a nurse or a doctor. It's very hard just to let the sensation in the body be and not know what's happening. So each Buddha ancestor, each practitioner, breaks through the intellectual thinking and passes the barrier individually. Each of us is doing it on our own. Nobody can do it for us. Nobody can tell us how to do it, to get through our concepts. If you've been practicing for a while, you've heard the teaching that concepts are not reality. We make up stories about reality. These are called concepts, ideas, descriptions. They're not, these are concepts prevent us from actually seeing what's real, what's there, free of the stories, the ideas in our mind. Our senses are interpreted by our mind. Right now, one of my favorite lines from Suzuki Roshi teachings, you're hearing my voice, but you're listening to the sound of your own consciousness. Mm. Mm. Whatever you hear is being interpreted by the sound of, by your own consciousness. So raindrops, the crack of thunder, a car passing, whatever you hear, each of us interprets it personally, individually. If somebody says something pleasant to you, you will interpret it in some way. If it's unpleasant, you'll interpret it another way. You don't quite know what the person had in mind, but your mind will make up a story. Until we catch our minds making up stories like this all the time, we can't break through. You can't see it happening. You can't get it that your mind is distorting. And practice is to allow us to see that our mind is interpreting the world. That we're not seeing the world as it arises. Our mind is defining it, interpreting it, telling us it's good or bad, it's beautiful or ugly. I don't know how many of you know much about John Cage, but he's the one, the composer, he took on the challenge of listening to sounds and not judging them.
He 4 minutes and 33 seconds? Sorry.
Yeah. And there's a story that he practiced for a long time so that he could hear the refrigerator in his apartment and find it beautiful or not be bothered by it. Maybe not beautiful, but at least not irritating. After I read this, you know, it was a real challenge to me, and I was walking on High Street around the campus. And on a morning when the recycling trucks were going by, stopping at every house and picking up stuff, and I was trying really hard to be neutral about it, and it was not easy. I didn't really succeed, but I stayed with it because I wanted to see what, this is what we're talking about, stuff that you decide is ugly, unpleasant, dangerous, whatever. If it's dangerous, you know, we have to practice with our common sense. But there's one line that we're practicing. This may sound like idealistic practice, to not wish that there was more brightness in the moon or more color in the flowers, to look at the world and not want it to be different. Do you find that you look, when you look at flowers or you look at people or you look at whatever, you're kind of always editing it a little bit. You're kind of seeing it the way you'd really like it to be. Or, so practice is to notice that we're doing that, and therefore we're never really validating each thing as it is. That means the mind is always good, bad, good, bad, good, bad. And it's that good, bad mind that, which is the sea of birth and death. It's the sea of, it's the consciousness of suffering.
Mm-hmm.
This is the, if the world is always good or bad, especially if it's good, it's the other side of bad. So you're always uncomfortable, very excited about somebody. The other side of that is, you know, discouraged and rejecting, downplaying somebody. I want to get away from that person. They're not good enough for me. I want to hang out with the most popular girl in the class or the most popular boy in the class. I don't want to be around somebody who's not, you know, with it. We saw The Social Network.
What's that?
The movie.
Facebook movie.
Oh, right.
What a painful movie to sit through. Painful to experience, re-experience your college years and all that stuff. We were involved in all that stuff. Being part of the right club, having the right reputation, beating somebody out, losing. Vasya called it the hell realm. You know, you spend 2 hours and something in the hell realm when you watch that movie. Closely investigate these words by the Buddha. Oh, wait a minute. Now I'll go to the third paragraph. The Buddha said, elements come together and form this body. At the time of appearing, elements appear. At the time of disappearing, elements disappear. Okay, what he means by elements, I think. I just want for our purposes this evening to talk about our senses. We are comprised of sense organs, eyes, ears, nose, tongue, body and mind, feelings, thoughts, sensations. Buddhism gives us some categories of like this, we call them the skandhas, the five aggregates or heaps. We have five categories of elements that create a body mind. So he's saying here that elements come together. You know, some of us may have seen images of fetuses, sperm and the ovum. Is that the right language? Sperm.
Well, that's before is the fetus.
What was that?
Before the fetus, there's the...
Yeah. When you finally see the image in the woman's body, this is the coming together of contributions from the father and the mother, and then as you watch the fetus develop, it develops, you know, to a recognizable, you know, set of equipment. Arms, legs, eyes. Elements come together and form this body. It takes 9 months for all these parts of the body to come together. When they come together, we call it a body. At the time of appearing, you have to read this kind of slowly with a big mind. At the time of appearing, elements appear. Dogen complicates it a little bit. It's not just intellectually rigorous. He's writing with a poetic, imaginative, big mind. using his imagination. At the time of appearing, it's elements that appear. At the time of disappearing, elements disappear. I had a student who died some months ago. He's saying, instead of Tay dying, elements, the elements of her body disappeared. That's another way of understanding what happened. When elements appear, I do not say, I appear. This is basic Buddhism. We don't identify as self. When elements disappear, I do not say, I disappear. So he's talking that adding the I, adding the name, adding Catherine to me, or Dr. Galuski to Reverend Galuski, changes your perception of him. Changes his definition and perception of himself, his expectations of himself. When he announces that I'm the abbot, you know, you have certain expectations of me. I have some expectations of myself. If he hadn't added that, and I just showed up, and this was just Catherine, it would be a different event. You'd have different expectations, ideas, disappointments. You might take what I'm saying more seriously or less seriously. We do that all the time. What do you do? You ask people when you meet them, what do you do? Trying to figure out what to think about them, how to peg them some way, instead of discovering, just being with the person. Then he goes on to say, past moments and future moments do not arise in sequence, and past elements and future elements are not in alignment. He's talking about time and space, that are past moments and future moments do not come sequentially. They don't follow a fixed course. Moments aren't lined up that way. Moments are more, they're freer, and elements are freer. That we exist in the realm of a sequence of time and space, and we exist outside of time and space. We exist in the realm of not of timelessness and non-space. When we're in the deep ocean, coursing along the bottom, we're in our timeless space. That's the big mind. That's the Bodhisattva practice. So simultaneously, each moment, we're existing in the realm, in the sea of birth and death, where we have thoughts and feelings and are making judgments, criticizing ourselves and criticizing others. And simultaneously, we are coursing along the bottom in big mind. Big mind is always present, quiet, just holding everything. Some of you may know that Robert Aitken Roshi died a few months ago. In about a week, there's going to be a memorial service in Berkeley, California for him. After he died, all the Dharma teachers began sending condolences to his disciples online. There was quite an outpouring of appreciation for his contributions. his writing, his teaching. He was kind of the elder statesman of Zen in this country. He lived to be 92. And I went back to some of his books at that time. I picked up a book I don't think I had read before, but that I had in my library, Original Dwelling Place. And in there is an essay. He's quite a literary stylist. He was devoted to literature. And he talked about, anybody here do this ceremony in Meijuku Kanon-gyo, a healing ceremony? We do that in the Zen tradition. If somebody is ill, we chant for them. And he's writing several pages explaining what that chant is about. I had not known how to understand it, and he translated it into English, and it doesn't make a lot of sense into English, so he was going through that rather carefully, very carefully. And somewhere in that essay, he starts talking about a Zazen experience he had when he had an image of a big organic mass kind of pulsing in his, and he knew that what he was seeing was his mind. I thought this was fabulous. And there was there was an opening, either a mouth or a vagina, and little beings were rushing out as fast as they could. Wow. You know, so fast. And he knew he was watching thoughts. He knew he was watching his thoughts. That's how fast we think. We can't keep up with it. You know, Kadigiri Roshi used to say, a thought is 1/65th of a second. And he'd get the snap of a finger, and he'd do, I can't make the snap sound. That's how fast, that's the duration of a thought. It's that fast. And 65 of them in a second. Mm. He knew, I was just astonished to read this, that he saw his mind, that image of his mind, and thoughts, saw how fast his thoughts were moving. We have, when we have meditation retreats, sometimes our thoughts slow down. Just the 5 days or 7 day meditation retreats, we get quiet, you know, we get tired, we get rather tired of our mind, all of our obsessive thoughts. It slows down. And those thoughts might slow down. I never had that kind of an image myself, but ever since I read about it, I thought, that's pretty good, you know, if you put it in your mind, maybe you can bring it forth. Of course, as soon as you think about it, it's gone. You can't do it. You can't have that kind of goal. So, oh my goodness, it's time to stop. Am I at a place where I can stop?
I think so.
That's always the case.
Excuse me?
That's always the case.
It's always the case. I'm sorry it took. I've been talking so much. Maybe if we have time for questions, or is it?
I think a couple of questions.
Yeah. Any comments or questions?
I think the biggest thing I struggle with is just trying to allow things to be, but also, and I struggle with direction too. You know, like, I feel like if you're supposed to just let things be, how can you get anywhere? That's what I struggle with, you know. The concept of filtering things, like you were saying, I don't want to be with this person, I don't want to be with this person. Well, if you don't do that, then what happens? If you just are with anybody, then what? I'm not saying that I don't want to be with unpopular people. I'm saying that when you're with people, and let's say they're negative or whatever, and you choose not to be with them. Sometimes I think that the teachings are saying that you just let things be and don't judge and just let it be, but there's a certain amount of, like, the arrow goes through and you have to let it cut things away to go somewhere. Does that make any sense? No.
Well, you're talking about your karmic mind and judgments and ideas of good and bad. And one of the benefits of practice is that we can see that we're constantly dividing the world into what's good and what's bad, what's acceptable and what's not acceptable, what will build us up and what will tear us down. And these are just ideas. I think it's helpful to become sensitive to your experiences of people, to have a sense of your body experience of someone, so that you can choose to be with people that feel good to you, that you feel safe with. That this is coming from a body rather than coming from an idea that this is an important person I should be around. And it's not so... we're making these discriminations all the time about people. This is a person I want to hang out with. But I think we can learn to make them slightly on a slightly different basis, from a deeper basis. What's really, where do I really feel safe? What's really good for me? What lifts my energy rather than what... Some people, your energy drops around them. Some people, your energy comes up. So when you're in a somewhat unsettled state, it's good to be around people that are positive for you, that your energy is encouraged by.
Mm-hmm. That makes sense.
And then when you're feeling more positive and kind of affirmed by someone or feel safe with someone, your thinking might be a little clearer. It might be a little easier to make judgments about where you should go, you know, what direction you should take. And then whatever decision you make, be open for where you go from there. It might not be your final destination, you know, it just might be a direction, and then from there you'll see what's right for, you know, what other step you might take.
Right. So when I make decisions about, you know, where I want to go in my life, then it should be from a bodily feeling, like how I
think, well, I don't know you. I can't say exactly, you know, when we're settled in the body and calm and at ease with ourselves, that's the time to make decisions, important decisions. So the first thing would be to get to the place where we're settled, where we're kind of calm about ourselves, where we trust ourselves, where we trust the decisions we make rather than compensating for perceived deficiencies in us.
Mm-hmm. That makes a lot of sense. Thank you.
So find someone that you really trust, you know, and you feel safe with. Or a lot of people that you feel safe with. Thank you very much.
Thank you. So when we're done in here, everyone is welcome to stick around and join us in the kitchen for tea and cookies and more conversation. And Catherine has come here on her own without any support beyond what we can offer through the practice of Dana Paramita, or generosity. And so in the kitchen, you'll see an envelope with her name on it. And if you're able to offer a donation to support Catherine's teaching, very gratefully appreciated. And next week we have another special guest, Susan Moon.